Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCane. Imagine a nation where politicians put country over party, where decisions are made for the greater good, not the benefit of political donors, where talent and a passion for public service count for more than the size of a candidate's war chest, where civility and compromise are rewarded, not punished. This is the vision of a wonderful group called Represent Us, and they have a winning plan to make that vision a reality. We want an America where the government works for everyone, not just the billionaires and special interests. But as most Americans know, the government often works well for the wealthy, but not the rest of us. On issue after issue, majority opinion of the people is overruled by wealthy donors and corporations. Special interests dominate public interests. Realizing this reality makes many Americans feel their voice and their vote doesn't matter, so they tune out and drop out. Only about half the people bother to vote, and in local elections and primaries, often far fewer than that. Underlying all the issues we care about is the need for democratic reforms that make elected officials more responsive to we the people. Happily, millions of Americans are rising up to organize and mobilize for systemic changes that make government more responsive to the regular folks. A key leader in this U.S. democracy movement is our guest today, Josh Silver, Executive Director of Represent Us. This past weekend, Josh organized Unrig the System, the largest gathering of democracy activists in the country. Over 2,000 people gathered in Nashville to share stories and strategies for taking back our country. Josh is here with us today to talk about what happened this weekend at Unrig the System and about his strategy for taking back our country from the billionaires and special interests. Josh Silver, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I want to congratulate you on a highly successful conference. I think it was certainly one of the best organized and the most important conferences I've ever attended. So you did a fabulous job. Tell us why you organized Unrig the System.
Well, you know, I think we're in a situation, Eleanor, where, you know, the American people are scratching their heads trying to figure out how is it that government is so gridlocked and polarized? How is it that special interest lobbyists are running away with the store, so to speak, and that the preferences of the average American, just the everyday American, are just essentially discarded and ignored by our elected leaders? And why is it that climate and education and poverty and healthcare and so many other, really all the most vital issues, are being either overlooked or moving backwards or are gridlocked and we're not seeing common sense decisions? And more people are realizing that the foundation of this dysfunction are these wonky issues that people generally overlook, which is the broken and antiquated laws that determine how our candidates are elected, how we the people are voting, and how our politicians govern once in office. And so there's this movement built around this Unrig summit that you've described of people who are following in the footsteps of marriage equality, of women's right to vote, of marijuana decriminalization. Regardless of your view on those issues, those are issues that were stuck, and then they took the fight local, winning at the city and state level, and did that, and in so doing, triggered a rush of state activity that led to federal reform. And we're seeing that from coast to coast, from anti-gerrymandering ballot initiatives, five of which passed in 2018, ranked choice voting passed two times in the state of Maine, which enables independent and third-party candidates to run and win and moderates politics. That passed in Maine and became the first use of such a system for federal elections ever last year, to ethics and campaign finance reforms in Alaska and North Dakota and Arizona. And the list goes on, automatic voter registration, vote from home, all these wonky issues, which before you fall asleep as I rattle them off, just know that they are the foundation of the political dysfunction that is so vexing.
Well, I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, and you've got a great analysis of what's wrong with our political system and what can be made right to fix it. So I agree with you. I think some people might think they're a little wonky. You know, some people's eyes glaze over. You talk about gerrymandering. But what amazed me at your conference this weekend, that you had over 2,000 people from all 50 states and the District of Columbia engaged in one initiative after another at the local and state level to make some of these democracy reforms happen, and they're right in there. They're talking about all these. So I want to, for our listeners who may not be familiar with some of this, I want to go into each of these a little bit so we can just make sure our listeners are familiar with some of these possibilities. And I'm going to start with the big one that most people are aware of, the problem of money in politics. We see the wealthy winning. We know senators in expensive seats have to raise $45,000 every day for 6 years to finance their campaigns. So we need another way to deal with money in politics. What do you see as some of the bright lights happening at the local and state level that help us get around this problem of money in politics?
Well, you know, you've just started with one of the most profound and impactful reforms, and one that is probably lagging behind the others slightly. Now, there's some really good news. We all know that the public funding of elections is really the only solution to the money in politics problem. What is that? What I mean is public funding being allowing taxpayers to direct a small portion of their of the money they would normally pay to the IRS and instead direct it to qualified political candidates to fund their campaigns, essentially in fueling every single constituent, every voter, to be a political donor, irrespective of their wealth. And this is something you see in Europe and most other advanced democracies. It's something that has existed in several states in the United States, from Maine to Arizona to Connecticut to Minnesota, and in many different cities. But what's been really encouraging is that back in 2015, the city of Seattle passed something called voucher-style public funding for the first time ever, which essentially just gave every voter in Seattle $100 that they could spend in this way. And the results have been fantastic. It's a simplified version of public funding. There's been different versions passed in history, but it's been super effective. Almost all of the city council and the mayor were elected using this system, and it frees politicians from the grip of big money and makes them accountable and answerable to their constituents. And frankly, it's really the best way, because things like lowering campaign contributions, disclosure of political donors, these are all important and we support them, but they're not as impactful as public funding, because public funding completely changes the incentives of political candidates, as opposed to trying to constrict the spending of candidates, which, you know, big money in politics is like water through a roof. If there's any little hole, it finds its way down and corrodes the process.
Exactly right. And I was so inspired by the people from Seattle talking about their initiative there for the vouchers. And one of the things that struck me, because I've run campaigns, I was a campaign manager in the city of Boston, and I know what it takes to try and get the money. It's, you know, money is the mother's milk of every campaign. If you don't have the money, you don't have a campaign. So it's essential, but it's such a rat race trying to run around and get it. And I can see where so many candidates end up spending a lot of their time with the big donors trying to get the funds they need. And what really struck me about the woman talking from Seattle was that once these vouchers were given, like every citizen, as you mentioned, gets $100. They had four vouchers each worth $25 that they could give, you know, one to four different candidates or all four of them to one candidate that they really liked. And what it meant then is candidates, instead of needing to spend all their time on the rich side of town kind of rubbing elbows with the wealthy donors, that they actually, the candidates could make more money going down to a union hall or to a community group because there are a lot more voters. Each one of them had $100 that they knew could be donated. So you're right. It changed the way that the candidates campaign and made them need to listen more to regular folks, not just the rich folks. So I think that's a really effective model. Hats off to Seattle. And did your group Represent Us have any role in supporting the Seattle initiative to pass democracy dollars?
We did. In fact, we were the ones who inspired it. We came into the state in 2013 with the goal of trying to pass these vouchers at the statewide level. And some activists in Seattle saw the model and said, that is smart, and inspired them to do it there. We supported that campaign in a number of ways. But here's what's interesting, Eleanor. This is why, and this is really important for your listeners, especially you know, anybody who believes for a second that Democrats are good on campaign finance reform and Republicans are bad. Well, you're not really right. You're right in that the Republicans have been horrible on the issue, and the Democrats have been sporadically or periodically good on the issue. But the fact is that real meaningful campaign finance reform is generally opposed by whomever is in power, Democrat or Republican. When we tried to pass voucher-style public funding in the state of Washington in 2016, we were actually taken down quietly by a major union and by the Democratic Party, who felt, because they felt correctly that they were doing relatively well in Washington state, unlike most of the country. Democrats and the unions are doing relatively well in that state, and they said, the system ain't broke for us, don't fix it. And they went to great pains to kill the ballot initiative that we tried to pass in that state.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, I think you're right. I think, you know, whoever's in power wants to design the rules in a way that they get to stay in power. And that raises another issue, which is very important, which, you know, more and more people are finding out about. It's called gerrymandering, and it's basically where politicians draw district lines to protect those who are in office to favor one party over another. And, you know, it makes almost all or very many of the seats, you say 86% of the seats, uncompetitive. So now, precisely because this is kind of an inside baseball kind of issue in politics, not a lot of people have known about it. So these drawing of the lines has been happening kind of, you know, behind the scenes. But more and more people are becoming aware of just how limiting and how dangerous this practice is. Can you talk a little bit about gerrymandering and how we can redraw the district lines in a way that's more sensible and more fair?
Sure. Now, to be clear, there is a little bit of a myth, let's call it a myth, about gerrymandering, and that is people think of gerrymandering as a competition problem, right? It's the whichever political party today is in power in most states, at the end of the census, which happens every 10 years, that political party shall redraw the districts as they see fit. And this has created gerrymandering because they redraw the districts, these House, U.S. House congressional districts, in such a way that prevents competition so that their party wins and the other party loses. Both parties do it. Republicans have done it much better than Democrats. And it is undemocratic. It is politicians choosing voters instead of voters choosing politicians. Now, the interesting thing about gerrymandering, Eleanor, is it goes way beyond competition. It is one of the primary sources or reasons for political extremism and gridlock and polarization. Why? Because today, 86% of U.S. House races are uncompetitive because of gerrymandering. Just 14% are competitive. And what that means is the only time that races for Congress are competitive is in the primary election, because in the general, as I just said, there's no competition to speak of. Primary elections have low turnout for voters, and the voters that do turn out for primary elections are reliably the most extreme, the most sort of extreme to the right, extreme to the left. And so what happens is politicians, because of gerrymandering, are structurally incentivized to take policy positions that are in line with the most extreme wing of their party. And then if you see that the Republicans have done a better job of gerrymandering, if you're a political operative, then you see why you've got these large numbers of politicians who take positions like opposing basic background checks for guns, despite the fact that over 80% of Republicans want that. The primary voters are much more red meat extremist and don't. So gerrymandering is key, and over the last, 12 years, you've seen this explosion in positive developments on gerrymandering. In 2008, we saw the state of California create an independent redistricting commission, a commission comprised of a large number of independents who redraw the lines every 10 years instead of the political party in power. And then you saw a similar measure pass in Arizona in 2010. And then last year, a stunning set of victories, five states, passed independent or bipartisan redistricting commissions in the states of Missouri, Michigan, Ohio, Colorado, and Utah. Unprecedented, and it sparked this wave of anti-gerrymandering activism that looks like it will continue to roll at a fast clip in 2020.
Yeah, that's a great description of gerrymandering, what it is and why it's so important. And I was really moved at the Unrig the System conference this weekend, listening to the young woman, Katie Fahey, who led the charge in Michigan to change the way that the district lines are drawn. And she talked about how she began the whole drive to have a more healthy and fair way of drawing the district line by a Facebook post where she basically said, I want to change gerrymandering in the state of Michigan. Who wants to help me? And then ended up having hundreds of people contact her, and she ended up learning more than she ever expected she would, led the drive, got the signatures to get an initiative on the ballot, and ended up winning. I think they got like 61% of the vote, or a really commanding win. So it's amazing as someone who had never really been involved before, but then kind of realized this was a key issue that needed to be addressed, just put up a Facebook post and gathered with the people who responded and made it happen. It's that kind of story that I find so inspiring, that people are stepping up all over the country to really make a difference on some of these key reform issues.
Yeah, and I think that's why this Unrig Summit in Nashville last week, and folks, if you're listening and you want to get some of the highlights, you can go to unrigsummit.com. That's unrigsummit.com, and there's photos and video. It's just phenomenal. But that's why it was so exciting, was seeing these people, hearing the stories from Katie Fahey and others who took matters, regular folks, who took matters into their own hands and profoundly changed democracy policy in their own state. And with it, they are profoundly changing the arc of American history. Because the fact is, if we don't figure this out, if we don't change how democracy works, how elections function, how we vote, how politicians govern, we are not going to have a viable democracy. And if we don't have a viable democracy, we won't have a viable country. So this is really about the future of our country herself and future generations. This is the ultimate national imperative.
Right, exactly right. Well said. And one of the other issues were, you know, people stepping up, you know, regular folk stepping up to make a difference was in the area of voting rights. Now, we've been watching over the past years since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act and took away a lot of the protections to make sure that voting was fair. We're seeing massive voter suppression in Georgia and Florida and Wisconsin, many states around the country, hundreds of thousands of voters being knocked out of the rolls, mostly Democrats being pushed out, a lot of African Americans. So it's a big concern. And in the face of that, we see now some people stepping up. Tell us the story of the re-enfranchisement that happened in the state of Florida and the amazing man who led it.
Well, so this is pretty incredible. I mean, most people, most sane people are stunned to learn that in many states, folks who have been convicted of a felon at any time in their lives are disallowed from voting for the rest of their lives, disallowed. And in Florida, that added up to 1.4 million former felons who were disallowed to vote permanently. A fellow named Desmond Mead from Florida, a guy who used to be homeless, who used to be living under the tracks, and then took himself out of poverty, got himself a law degree, and came to run an organization that is called the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, pulled together an incredible coalition, raised over $10 million, and put a ballot initiative forward in November that won handily and re-enfranchised 1.4 million voters. This is a human rights issue. It was incredibly inspiring. There were many people who felt they felt that this would be impossible. They say, "Oh, this is a very difficult to for anybody to get their head around, and you know that people aren't going to want felons voting." Well, they did, and it worked, and it was just incredibly inspiring. And Desmond was in Nashville to share his story with us.
Yes, and I loved him, and I loved the story, and I loved the way he talked about what he did. Desmond Mead is a really big fellow African-American, and he talked about how moved he was that they got whatever it was, I think it was 5.1 million votes in favor of re-enfranchisement for the returning citizens. And he pointed out, to get that big of a vote, they needed to be drawing on not just liberal Democrats, but, you know, moderates, independents, and Republicans all had to be voting in favor of it, and that it was a vote not voting their fear, but it was a vote for love and forgiveness and redemption. It was, you know, just very deeply moving, and I can see why his leadership was just so powerful. But for all of our listeners who are at home thinking, well, you know, what can I do? So, well, here's a fellow who was homeless and got his life together and then ended up leading the largest re-enfranchisement of voters since women got the right to vote back in 1920. So there's something that all of us can do. And, well, Josh, you're working with all these folks. For our listeners who want to do something, what do you suggest? How can they get involved?
The best way is go to represent.us, because what we do, and part of the reason why we host this summit, Eleanor, is that we are we're basically connecting people like folks listening to this show to the action. We are doing two things. One, if there's something happening in your community, we will connect you to what's happening in your community and so that you can engage. Or two, if there's not something happening in your community and you want to, we provide you with tools in order to be able to get to work. And it's really exciting. You just go to represent.us. Now, you mentioned something in passing that's really important, and that is that it is conservatives, moderates, and progressives working together to fix these problems. And this can sound really like alien to people who are decidedly
especially these days
or decidedly progressive. Like you work in your tribe, you hate the other side, you don't agree with them on anything. But this is what's so unique about this democracy movement that's growing, and that is that on these issues that I've been describing, there is near unanimous agreement from grassroots, progressives, moderates, libertarians, conservatives. Truly, like conservatives and progressives both support these reforms. They support automatic voter registration. Conservatives might not like same-day registration. They might support voter ID. But if you ask them, what do you think of automatic voter registration, which is basically making it so that you use already existing ways that government verifies who you are, such as registering a car or getting a driver's license or getting food stamps, well, then you're registered to vote automatically. Well, they support that, and across the board they do. So this takes people letting go of some kind of previous misconceptions about liberals and conservatives, and it requires that you start afresh and say, you know what, I may not agree with this person on abortion. I may not agree with them on gay rights. I may not agree with them on military intervention. I may not agree with them on taxes. But I do agree with them that we need to unrig the system and pass these profound, transformative democracy reforms. So I'm willing to set that other stuff aside and get to work on this common ground. And I'm willing to do it because I understand that if I change the rules, then we can have elected officials who will act in the interests of either their constituents or truly follow their heart, rather than following the wishes of political extremists in the primary election or political donors. And that's what we're after.
Fantastic. I think that's so true. And as you point out so rightly, it's so important to be drawing across the political spectrum on this that just look at the numbers. If you've got 35% in a recent Gallup poll show, 35% of the country considers themselves conservative, 35% consider themselves moderate, and 26% consider themselves liberal. None of those alone are going to make a majority to be able to pass these referenda or other bills. So we need to have a coalition, which you do, and rightly, I mean, these are not left-right issues. These are American issues. These all go to the heart of our democratic republic here. And, you know, when you mentioned about if we change the rules, politicians will be listening to the people again, it made me wonder if you have read the book Democracy in Chains by Professor Nancy MacLean of Duke University. We had her on the show recently talking about this. That's been a definite initiative by the Koch brothers for years to change not only the rulers of who's in elected office, but also to change the rules in a way that favors the wealthy elite. And we're trying to change the rules in the back. Have you had a chance to see that book, Democracy in Chains?
I have not. It's on my list, but I've not read it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've been busy with the campaigns and with your wonderful conference, but I encourage you to take a look at that book. She exposes how this is not just like these problems didn't just happen of themselves, that there's been an orchestrated initiative strategically by the Koch brothers to change the rules to favor the elite and the wealthy. So, you know, that's kind of, it's good to know what we're up against, and then we can see kind of a clear path to victory, which you've laid out a beautiful strategy here, which I love. It's one of the best strategic plans I've ever seen, and I've worked on a lot of them. So you've got a great sense of what the problem is and what we do about it. And more, let's go back to some of these specific reforms. The one that really stood out for me, which I hadn't focused a lot on before, was a thing that needs a new name. It's called ranked choice voting, but I don't know what we can call it.
I love that you pointed it out, because you're completely right. And ranked choice voting really is awesome. It's used in about 8 countries around the world, like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, the Czech Republic. And it's also used in about 12 cities in the United States. And what's really notable about ranked choice voting, and the reason I'm very excited about it, is that it lets the voter choose their candidates based on preference. This is my first choice. Eleanor is my first choice. Josh is my second choice. And Bob is my third choice. Well, they tally up the votes. And if one of the candidates wins a majority, that is more than 50%, well, they win the election. But if they don't, and this is often the case when you have multiple candidates, what happens is you have an instant runoff where the lowest scoring candidate is eliminated, and whoever voted for him or her, well, their second place vote is instantly applied to the remaining candidate. And you keep doing that, dropping the lowest scoring candidate, applying the second place votes to that candidate, to the remaining candidates, and you do that until eventually somebody, it's one of the candidates, has more than 50% of the vote. And it's fantastic because you can vote for who you actually support, knowing that if they lose, there's a high likelihood that your second place vote will be counted towards the remaining candidates. It does a few things. One, it creates more civility. We saw campaign TV commercials coming out of the state of Maine last year where you literally had two independent candidates sitting there next to each other saying, hey, with ranked choice voting, you're not throwing your vote away, you're not spoiling the election for one of the major party candidates if you vote for us, and hey, vote for one of us, and if you don't pick one of us, pick the other one of us as your second place choice. And it was like incredibly collegial. It was interesting that in the Congressional District 2 in Maine last year, the Republican ended up getting 49% of the vote, the Democrat ended up getting 48% of the vote, and the remaining 3% of the vote for this congressional district was split between two independent candidates. Well, guess what? They eliminated the independent candidates in the way that I've described, reapplied the votes, and the Democrat, who had 48%, they had fewer votes than a Republican in the first round, actually won that race. Now, that is a victory, not because the Democrat won. It was a victory and a proof of concept, because what it did was it showed that the independent candidates had a voter base that was more progressive than conservative, and the candidate with the larger base of ideological support won that election, and that is awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome, and that should be what America's about, because it solves the problem. This approach of ranked choice voting solves the problem that actually you mentioned, Maine. It's a problem Maine had, where in the governor's race, the last two prior elections, there was a split field, and one guy got like 37% of the vote. And he was kind of like a raving maniac. He was just a little unhinged and did not represent the views or values of the majority of Mainers. But because the vote was split, he kind of edged out the other candidates, and he got more votes than them. So at 37% of the vote, he ended up becoming the governor, not once, but twice. And people were kind of pulling their hair out.
And Donald Trump, who is a madman extremist, in my view, exit surveys show that ranked choice voting would have gotten a more moderate candidate elected, and that's what we're looking for.
Right, exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the story of what happened in Maine and how they got ranked choice voting. I think it's important for several reasons. One is it says people can take action and get this approach to voting by rank in their state, but then you can't take it for granted. They got it passed, and then the state legislature tried to not do it and repeal it. Tell us, so we have to stay in the game. Even when you pass these laws or pass these ballot initiatives, You've got to stay on top of it, make sure it's funded, make sure it's enacted. Tell us the story of Maine with this ranked choice voting.
Well, Maine is reflective of a trend we're seeing all across the country where state legislatures are repealing or significantly altering laws passed at the ballot from coast to coast. Remember, roughly half of the American states have the ballot initiative process. Maine, of course, is one of them. Most of those states are out west, but you have some like Michigan, Ohio, Massachusetts, and Maine, Florida, Mississippi, Illinois, that do have the ballot initiative process. And in Maine, after ranked choice voting passed in 2016, in the 2017 legislature, they chose to repeal the whole law outright. Fortunately, in that state, there's something called a people's veto, which says that if that happens, the law can go back to the ballot if you gather another bundle of signatures, and voters get a second vote. And if the voters vote a second time to approve this ballot initiative, well, then it stays on the books. Not so lucky in other states. South Dakota, our organization, working with local partners, passed one of the most comprehensive campaign finance and public funding laws, I might add, in the state of South Dakota, a state that went 2-1 for Donald Trump the same year, passed a sweeping campaign finance and ethics law that created publicly funded elections in South Dakota, and the legislature promptly repealed that law. That's happening all over the country. It's a threat to democracy. It's a disturbing new trend, and it's something that we are having to take into account as we pursue these ballot initiatives. But rest assured, there's one silver lining, which is in most of the states, you can do either a what's called an initiated statute, you're changing the law, or through the ballot initiative process, you can actually amend the state constitution, which is essentially impossible for the legislature to change. So we're focusing more on amending the state constitutions in order to protect ourselves from this problem.
That's very interesting. So, well, the bottom line for Maine is that we the people won. I mean, the people got organized. They passed this ranked voting approach. Even though the legislature repealed it, the people went out and got more signatures, had another ballot, and passed it again. And now it is the law of the land, and they are voting with this whole wonderful ranked choice voting. And I'm going to give a bottle of champagne to the listener who comes up with a better name for voting by rank. But it's such
We're working on it. We're working on it.
All right. Well, maybe I'll give the champagne to you.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that South Dakota passed a great campaign finance bill only to have it revoked by the state. But in North Dakota, they had a big ethics reform bill this past year led by the very spirited, self-named Badass Grandmas. Tell us what happened in North Dakota this past year.
So North Dakota was inspired, the Badass Grandmas were inspired by South Dakota. And they said, we want to do something similar. Now, they did not include public funding because they didn't feel like they could win, and I think that's probably true. In North Dakota, the dynamics were different. But they put a ballot initiative forward. They got it on the ballot last year, and they won by a significant margin and passed the most comprehensive disclosure law in the country. That is, the law saying that if you donate to politics, whether through a PAC, super PAC, the contribution to campaigns, that you have to disclose everything. And that means, like, you know, today a lot of times that is obscured by, you know, funneling money through various entities so that you're hiding the money. You know, it goes from Joe to a company, and then it goes from the company to America's for a Better America. Then it goes to the campaign. This law makes it so that you have to be able to trace that money back to the actual source. It's something that drives the Koch brothers crazy. The Koch brothers are the most incensed by transparency. They want to keep big money hidden behind closed doors in cigar smoke-filled rooms. And it was just totally inspiring and just magical. It's good to see what those grandmas did in North Dakota with a bipartisan commission that they had, or rather a campaign committee. It was led by the three primary grandmas were a Republican, a Democrat, and an Independent, providing a model showing that this can be done.
That's fantastic. I loved all the grandmas, and they're so lively and so positive and really working for their grandkids and for the future, and just really enjoyed their spirit. So let's talk a little bit now about your organization, Represent Us. You were founded in 2012. Tell our listeners a little bit about the organization and your membership.
Sure. So we were founded in 2012 in order to pass campaign finance and ethics laws all around the country using ballot initiatives. Well, two things happened. One, we realized that there's a lot of tricky. It's very tricky to pass public funding for reasons I've already described. And we saw at the same time this emergence of this incredible number of reforms starting to bubble up organically all around the country across these issues, from anti-gerrymandering to ranked choice voting to campaign finance to automatic voter registration, vote from home, and others, voter re-enfranchisement. And so what we've seen is this democracy reform map just explode in recent years. It's one of the least told, sort of underreported stories in America. 2018 mm-hmm. saw more democracy reforms pass at the state and local level than ever passed in one year in the history of our country.
That is amazing. I just want to just pause and underscore that for our listeners. More democracy reforms passed last year than at any other time in the history of America. It's amazing.
So our organization went from one that was designed to try to start reforms and guide them across the finish line to we recognize that this was a major shift. And now what we do is we provide support for state and local campaigns that emerge across the country. So if a campaign has a smart policy that's impactful, a strong local coalition, and other dynamics that lend itself towards being both a game-changing reform and politically viable, well, we lean in with all kinds of different support, from policy drafting to political strategy to celebrity endorsements to digital advocacy to making TV ads, to mobilizing our grassroots activists, of which we have hundreds of thousands. We provide that network of support to help folks who might not know a whole lot but are well-intentioned to give them the expertise and assistance necessary to win. So that's really what Represent Us does while we build this movement.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think you're so right that I was astonished at how many people were there and the energy. And I follow politics very closely. I read three newspapers a day. I read lots of digital political media and magazines and books. And I myself was not aware of how vibrant the pro-democracy movement is in the United States until I was there this weekend at your conference, Unrig the System. So it's very inspiring. It's part of why I wanted to do a show for our listeners, to at least let our listeners know. But we want to get the word out so more people know where they can plug in. And I just want to repeat for our listeners, if you do want to connect in and get involved, go to represent.us and they can either connect you to someone in your communities doing some good democracy work or give you the tools so that you can become the person who goes from not engaged to a real leader to help save our country. And if you could just, Josh, you've got a fantastic strategy. Can you just succinctly summarize for our listeners, what is your strategy for how do we make the needed democracy reforms in the U.S.?
So the strategy is, Eleanor, that, you know, the states determine election law. This is explicit in the U.S. Constitution. The federal government, the U.S. Congress, does not determine election laws. The state does. When you realize that, in the same way you just underscored about 2018 being the most busy democracy reform year in our nation's history, you realize how profound it is that if you change how we vote with ranked choice voting, if you create automatic voter registration and vote from home, which allows you to actually take your ballot, everybody votes for 2.5 weeks you have at home with a ballot where you can Google candidates, learn really where they stand on issues, and take your time, mail your ballot in, that if you could pass anti-gerrymandering reforms, that you will fundamentally change the U.S. Congress and how we vote for our statewide electeds, our state legislatures, and our local officials. This is a profound change, and it's accompanied by simultaneous changes that must happen around campaign finance and ethics, which are not determined by the states, but in aggregate move us towards this trigger point that we have seen. A Bloomberg study looked at all these different issues that I'd mentioned earlier, from prohibition to women's right to vote, marriage equality, marijuana, biracial marriage, and found that there was a growing number of states that passed reforms in these areas until eventually, when you get to a critical mass of states that have passed this reform, it creates a trigger moment, usually a grassroots campaign reaching maturity or a major court decision that passes and changes federal law. So that's our theory of change. That's our strategy. And our goal at represent.us is to empower your listeners and everybody across the country to take these matters into their own hands and move reform at the local level. Because the fact is if your listeners know the movie The Matrix, there was that moment when Keanu Reeves was asked, do you want to take the blue pill and everything remains the same and you live in your fantasy land, or do you want to take the red pill and see reality as it really is? And once you've taken the red pill, once you fully understand how central democracy policy is to advancing or killing every issue that you hold dear and the issues that determine the future of our country and the world, like climate change, then you realize I'm tilting at windmills unless I'm actually actively working on democracy reform, and that's what we have to achieve.
Absolutely, and it's so essential work, and you're doing so much great work, and I so loved your conference, and I will be back. For people who want to go, are you going to do Unrig the System conference next year, or are you going to be supporting people in the field for the big 2020 election?
Yeah, so we are going to be doing it next year. It's unclear when, but we don't get involved in political races. We don't know exactly when, and we don't know exactly where, but if you go to unrigsummit.com, you can learn more about this year's, and you can sign up to get information as soon as we know where and when the next summit will be located.
Yeah, and then you talked about the way you support these state and local initiatives in your campaign hub with all kinds of ways to help out policy design, bringing in celebrities. We need to mention Jennifer Lawrence came and was very involved in your organization, not only at the conference this past weekend, but in many ways throughout the year. What do you do to help people stay connected with each other between the annual conferences?
So people who are on our list receive regular email updates. They are, as I mentioned, connected to local campaigns. It is true, the celebrity involvement has been absolutely essential. Ed Helms was there. Kerry Washington has been helpful. Michael Douglas is very actively involved in supporting this work. And the list goes on. The fact is that celebrity brings you cheap to free earned media. That is, you make a video with a celebrity, you don't have to pay $1 million for promotion. They sort of promote themselves thanks to the power of celebrity. And we saw the same thing with Jennifer Lawrence and Ed Helms in Nashville this last weekend. They brought energy, they light up a room, they make things a little more exciting. And I think you're only going to see more celebrities join on board with this movement as it gains steam.
Yeah, fantastic. And what is your cutting-edge growth? You're doing such fantastic work. If someone gave you a bunch of money right now, where would you expand? What would you do with it?
Well, the main way that we're expanding is in this project that I've described earlier we call the Campaign Hub. It's new. It's building this very robust set of assets across these different sectors, things that campaigns in cities and states need, but usually they're not qualified, they don't have the professional expertise to do right, or they hire professional political consultants who have never worked on the issue before and charge these campaigns boatloads of money and deliver a subpar product. So this is a problem that our organization is building a fix for, which is what we call the Campaign Hub, and essentially evaluates all the campaigns across the country and provides that critical support in a timely fashion that's needed to get a ballot initiative on the ballot or to create a robust lobbying campaign for a state legislative lobbying effort, sometimes even writes campaign contribution checks, sometimes goes after the bad guys with aggressive accountability campaigns, builds the very best digital assets using very almost creepy, cutting-edge, targeted, I say creepy because if you're going to be successful running advocacy campaigns through digital, you have to do phenomenal voter targeting, both on geography, disposition, inclination. It's a science, and we are at the forefront of it. So that's what our funding supports, is to build that apparatus, just in the same way that this group called Freedom to Marry did with gay marriage about 14 years ago. They built a similar apparatus that ended up being central to the success of that issue. We're just emulating them and doing the same in 2019.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's so great. I love to see that whole Campaign Hub because, you know, people like Katie Fahey in Michigan say, oh, well, I want to help change gerrymandering in Michigan, but then not know the first thing about how to do it. And then you're there with the experienced people that can help with the strategy, with the policy, shaping what the initiative could say, making sure there's broad-based support, maybe bringing in a celebrity. You know, all that amplification of the messaging that is so critical to success on a campaign, you're providing it to people like Katie Fahey in Michigan and the badass grandmas in North Dakota and all across the country. So I think that's fantastic. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure before we end the conversation that you tell us your story about how you got into this work. I know at the big Saturday night bash in Nashville with lots of great music and comedians, there were a couple of brief presentations, including yours, which I thought was fantastic. And you told us how it was that you got into this democracy work. Are you willing to share that story now with our listeners?
Of course. So it's not a very conventional story. Back in 1995, when I was 26 years old, I was on an adventure in the Peruvian Amazon in South America, and I was with a dear friend. We built a 15-foot by 15-foot raft. We got about a month's worth of provisions, and we set out for this epic adventure towards the city of Iquitos, in a city of 300,000 people in the middle of the jungle that doesn't even have roads to it. You have to take a boat or a plane to get there. It's fascinating. And 4 days into the trip, we were ambushed by folks who, in all likelihood, just wanted our stuff, and they had guns. And my friend Patchen Miller was shot and killed, and I was shot and left for dead. And it started an odyssey to get back to safety, which is chronicled in the best article is in Outside Magazine. If you Google Josh Silver in Outside Magazine, it's an excellent read. But for the details, but suffice it to say, I came home from the trip and I thought, wow, life is short.
Mm-hmm.
It's fragile, and I just had this abiding feeling like I wanted to take this gift I'd been given of this life that my friend Patchen had not, and I wanted to try to do something really, really positive with it. And I talked to some people. Actually, the man who, when he was young, had actually inspired the turning over of the Pentagon Papers. So when that was happening, the Vietnam War was
that Randy Keeler?
Yeah, you know Randy?
I know Randy, yes. I used to do some work with him.
So Randy was my mentor and my neighbor growing up. And Randy inspired me to get into money and politics back in 1997. And that started me on this career of working on this issue, getting at this root problem. Because people like Randy, as they can attest, that this is the one that affects everything else. And so that journey began, and I never looked back, and I never entered the for-profit sector, and I've been doing public interest work my entire life.
Well, that's an amazing story, and hats off to you for the incredibly important work you're doing, and you're doing it so beautifully well and so effective with such, you know, heart, with good strategy, and so with really caring about people and caring about our country. So that's all the time we have. Josh Silver, thank you so much for being with us today on All Together Now.
Oh, you're welcome. And folks, go to represent.us on the web and find out more.
Absolutely. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, Sun by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.